Michael Parenti is an historian and social science, the author of 18 books about social and political issues. His 19th book, called Super Patriotism, is about to come out within the next month. Some of the books are, you probably know about Democracy for the Few and To Kill a Nation. Michael is the author of those books. He knows history and he knows democracy. And he's been worried about our Democracy for the Few for a long time, and writing and explaining the underlying structures that have contributed to the erosion of our democracy. His latest book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, which was nominated last fall for a Pulitzer Prize. This book tells the compelling story of popular resistance against entrenched power, wealth, and corruption during the late Roman Republic. Sounds eerily familiar, doesn't it? Today, he will bring lessons from history from that time to our current global economy and how citizens and governments alike can help shape a more sustainable world. We are very honored to bring this distinguished writer and thinker to you. Let's give a warm welcome to Michael.
Thank you. I want to thank the Unitarian Universalist for a Just Economic Community for bringing me here today. Those of you who are planning to ask me at the end of this talk, yes, but what do we do about it? Then let me say right now, come work for the Unitarian Universalist for Just Economic Community. It's an organization that struggles against and fights against economic injustice and for all forms of social justice. They educate, they engage, and activate people, both Unitarian Universalists and even others have been known to be activated by them. And I would encourage you to get involved by joining and by making a contribution. What I'm going to talk about, a subject that really, I'm not going to talk about it. There's been some confusion. I couldn't find out what my talk was supposed to be today. I finally just heard what it was. But what I'm going to talk about is I'm going to talk about a subject that really consumes many people. It's the central organizing passion of their life. It's an intoxicant. It's something that's more important than anything else. They will kill for it. I'm going to talk about wealth. And I'm going to talk about class. Now, class, you usually can't on the left, the American left, you can't talk about class. You can talk about class like upper middle, lower middle, upper lower, you know, a status, a group, an income level, and that sort of thing. What you can't talk about is class as a dynamic, class as a relationship to class power and social power. That's what I want to talk about, class and wealth. Well, what is wealth? What is wealth? I mean, we're all interested in it, so where does it come from and what is it? Wealth has two basic sources, that's aside from its culturally defined dimensions. First, there's the natural resources of the planet, of the environment. That's the great basic source of wealth. The land, the fruits of the land and the forests, the subterranean resources, the mineral deposits and other rich deposits, the resources from the sea, salt, fish, kelp, the sun's energy. These are all sources, if harnessed and gathered, that become wealth. The second source is human labor. There's really no natural resource that automatically leaps into our mouths, certainly none that automatically leaps into our wallets or pockets. Even food gathering in a very lush, fertile community requires labor, the labor of gathering. Labor, then, is the vital other ingredient. And labor adds use value to resources, making them accessible, making them consumable, and therefore making them marketable. Labor adds, also adds market value. It transforms, for instance, what transforms a useless tree? And a tree is useless. I mean, a tree can be precious, it's beautiful, it's part of our survival, our health, environment. But for the market, it's useless. Unless it's on a property that enhances the value of the property. Someone sells you this and says, look, you got this beautiful oak tree here too, you know. We added $1,000 to the houses for that tree. But generally, what transforms a useless tree into a commodity that you can sell is the labor that goes into harvesting it, transporting it into lumber. Now, lumber itself is another marketable commodity, of course. That's a source of profit. And then that transforming that lumber into furniture, all the labor that goes into that, and all the labor that goes into advertising and selling it and transporting it and bringing it to your house. What do you want it, lady? And putting it down. All of that makes this, is what gives value to that tree. It's the labor. In food gathering and hunting, and even early horticultural societies, there was not much opportunity to accumulate wealth. I mean, if you were Native American Indian, you might want to own 2-3 horses. You might even have pride, but you couldn't own 200. You couldn't take care of them all. You wouldn't have any reason for that. There was a rough equality of life in early food gathering and horticultural societies. There was a place for everybody at the fireplace. There was a communal table. If there was abundance, it was shared by all, more or less. I mean, maybe the hunter who killed the buffalo got the first choice cut or something, but everybody, there was food pretty much for everybody. If there was scarcity, if the herds disappeared, if the crops failed, if there was hunger, that too was shared by all. This is what was called primitive communism by some. By late horticultural societies, by the time you develop agriculture and surpluses and such, larger tracts of land are cultivated, towns and settlements, larger concentrations of populations in abundant valleys, trade develops, and wealth accumulates. And we witness a very strange and unfortunate phenomenon. That is, those with a surplus abundance, instead of sharing, become more possessive. Surplus and accumulation stimulates the accumulation impulse. Those with large tracts of land and large herds want still larger tracts and larger herds. And to make sure they can keep them, they hire bands of retainers to protect what they have from the dispossessed. The beginnings of the state and the beginnings of class society. So in advanced horticultural societies, they also do something else. They use force and violence to enlist other people into the quotidian drudgery, into the toil of their plantations, their estates, their mines, and such. These other people are slaves. And the slaves create wealth through their labor by creating all of this stuff and consuming but a bare subsistence of it. Well, so class society, class conflict, these are, as I say, they're forbidden terms in U.S. political culture, even among many who pretend to be on the left. You're not going to hear too much of that. But thinking of class as more than just a sociological category or an income category, as I said, lower middle, upper middle, all that stuff, thinking of class as a dynamic interrelationship having to do with wealth. Class, in that sense, is not just a category or a status, it's a social relationship. There's no such thing as a class in isolation. You can't talk about slaves without talking about slaveholders and masters. You can't talk about lords without talking about vassals and serfs. You can't talk about corporate bosses without talking about workers and corporate employees. And what distinguishes each of them in each case is their relationship to a third factor. What distinguishes these, the few who own and the many who work for those who own, what distinguishes them is their relationship to this third factor, which is the means of production. That is, to the wealth, to the state power, to the land, the mines, the mills, the goods, the services. There are those who own things, and there are those who work for those who own things, who have nothing else, so they sell their labor power. That's most of us. That's what we've got to do. We've got to go find a job or a profession or something like that if we plan to pay the rent, whatever. Now, capital comes in two forms. There's both productive capital, that's the land, the mines, the mills, all that stuff, and then there's the material component of production. I mean, that is the material component of production, I just mentioned. And then there's financial capital. The goal of the modern capitalists, the modern transnational corporation, the goal of that organization is not productive capital or productivity as such. The goal is financial accumulation. And if maximizing your financial communication means intensifying your productivity, it'll do it. If maximizing your financial accumulation means minimizing productivity, taking certain things out of production, deindustrializing whole areas, buying up all the public assets in Eastern Europe and then just selling off the assets and deindustrializing them and closing them because you don't want their steel industry to compete with yours. You don't want their mining industry to compete with yours. You don't want their agribusiness to compete with your their collective farms to compete with your agribusiness. So you buy them up and then you put them out of business, which is what has been happening all over Europe. It's happening today now in Serbia, now that Serbia has the blessings of the free market capitalist democracy. David Broderick, former president of U.S. Steel, said it very nicely. I heard him once on TV. He said, U.S. Steel is not in the business of making steel. That was very smart. I came to the edge of my seat. I said, is he really going to say it? And you know what? He did. And then he didn't say, it's in the business of making a profit. He didn't say that. He said something better. He said, it's in the business of making the highest possible profit for its shareholders. That's what it's in the business of. That's what U.S. Steel is in the business of. That's what General Motors is. That's what General Electric is. That's what General Dynamics is. That's what all the generals are in the business of. Making sure that those who have shall have yet more. The highest possible profit. One of the key instruments for this accumulation process is a convention known as money. I was taught when I was in school that money is a medium of exchange. It's a way we can deal and exchange goods and services. And that has a really nice, neutral sounding ring to it. Money is a medium of exchange. Money can be used for good or bad. You can use money to build a hospital or to bribe an official. You can use money to enhance with scholarships or corrupt or kill or whatever. Actually, on further reflection, I decided that money is not a neutral thing. Money is not an instrument for good or bad. Money itself, by its very nature, historically in a class society, becomes a means of abstracting, mobilizing, and accumulating wealth. Otherwise, they wouldn't have invented it. They wouldn't put so much stock in it. They wouldn't be going after it so much. In the olden days, when wealth consisted principally of land, crops, herds, furs, silver plates, gold cups, jewelry, and such, you could accumulate just so much, and you can do just so much with it. But abstracted from material wealth, money becomes a very flexible, very powerful, very mobile tool for accumulation. In a world of rich and poor, there's nothing neutral about money. It's the same with technology. When they say technology is just a neutral instrument, you could use it for good, you could use it for bad. That's not true. Technology is developed within the framework of a social structure. Technology is developed by those who own and control technology, who have a lot of money. And they develop technologies of surveillance, they develop technologies of war, they develop technologies of self-promotion, of marketing. That's what they use technology for the most part. Cell phones are very tacky, I think. That's not what it means. I was listening to somebody who I consider to be the id of the right wing. You know, let's get Freudian about this. There's the super ego that puts the gloss and maintains the hypocritical appearances, and there's the ego that kind of goes out and gets it and tries to justify it and all. And then there's the id, the raw, primitive truth. I was listening to the id of the right wing, Rush Limbaugh. And he was saying, it's not a zero-sum game we have here in America. It's not a zero-sum game. When there's more for the big guys at the top, of which he is a multi-millionaire, he doesn't mention that. They never say that. They never come out and say, by the way, I'm one of those fat, greedy pigs that they talk about. He said, when there's more for them, there's also more for us. The pie gets bigger, we all get a bigger slice. It's not zero-sum. A rising tide lifts all boats. Well, you know, there's another saying. A rising tide sinks many boats, drowns many people. In fact, it can be zero sum, and to some extent it is. And I'll show you in a minute why. Now, before we get any further into the discussion of capitalism, it's at this point that we hear about the entrepreneurial spirit. Well, what about the guy who goes out, he has an idea, he develops a commodity, he gets a market, he hires people, and creates jobs. It's always said in that kind of nostalgic sing-song way, jobs, and makes a contribution to the community. You know, you could, by this time you're getting all moist-eyed, you know. And I always have to say, I'm not talking about those people. I'm not talking about mom-and-pop capitalism, okay? Lenin made the point. 5 million small businesses count for nothing. A few giant cartels count for everything. I'm talking about the people who have the muscle. I'm not talking about the squirrels who are dancing among the elephants and getting stomped out. 300-400 a week getting stomped out of business, small businesses, with others coming in. Of course, hope beats eternally. I'm talking about the elephants. I'm talking about those who are doing the stomping. I'm talking about the transnational monopoly finance capital reality, not the entrepreneurial mythology. So that's what we're talking about. And for them, it is, to some extent, zero sum. Great wealth creates great poverty. There's not just an innocent juxtaposition. We always point out that juxtaposition. We always say, isn't it tragic? So much wealth right next to so much poverty here. Isn't this terrible? As if they're just sitting there in embarrassing juxtaposition. No. Great wealth causes great poverty. You can't have great wealth unless you have poverty. You can't have rich slaveholders living on these big plantations, living a life like that, unless you have impoverished slaves. You can't have the lord born to the manor unless you have the serfs who do all that work for him. And you can't have great transnational corporations unless you have workers who work all their lives living from hand to mouth and who end up with a miserable little pension if they're lucky. Now the wealthy class doesn't just sit there with the wealth, it translates its wealth into political power, into social control, and into cultural hegemony. In time, the ever-expanding wealth and the ever-expanding appetite for wealth goes abroad. It has to look for other places to carve out natural resources, to exploit even cheaper labor, especially when their own workers start putting all sorts of ridiculous, stupid, wasteful demands on you, like a living wage, a pension fund, vacations, occupational safety, consumer protections, environmental protections. When will it stop? What are they doing? Waste every dollar spent, wasted on stupid things like that, is one less dollar in my pocket. So I go to Indonesia. I go to Haiti, where I can pay people not $15 an hour, not $1 an hour, but $1 a day. That's where I go to. So they go abroad. And there too, it's zero sum. Empire brings great wealth to the investing class and great expense for the people of the imperial nation. The process of empire, in case you want to know, the process of empire is what is called imperialism. And imperialism is when the ruling interests of one country expropriate or exploit the land, the labor, the natural resources, the markets, and the capital and technology of another country. That's what imperialism is. So these ruling interests do the same to the people in these other places as they do to people here. The patricians pursue their far-off plunder, and we, the people, are also very much involved in empire in terms of its costs. They get the benefits, and we get the costs. We pay the taxes, and we pay the blood. The empire feeds off the republic. The empire has more power, more grandeur, more scope, more reach, more striking force than ever. It is one of the wonders of human history. And the Republic has public hospitals that are closing, public schools that are closing, kids who haven't had one teacher in a term for years but have had seen 15 different substitutes in 3 months, schools that don't even have enough textbooks, schools where the roofs are leaking, housing so miserable that we have hundreds of thousands of homeless, beggary all over in an empire that's so ever rich. You see it happen this very year. Dramatic, dramatic instances of states and cities saying we are going bankrupt. We cannot meet our budgets. We are in a state of crisis. We will have to cut back our human services. And meanwhile, $200 billion being spent over the $402 billion that's being spent on the military budget, over that $200 billion being spent on the war in Iraq, with fat billion-dollar contracts for Halliburton and Bechtel and 70 other U.S. corporations, and also access to a huge trove of oil worth about $3 to $4 trillion. And that's really one of the compelling reasons why the U.S. feels, U.S. rulers suddenly feel so compelled to bring democracy and electricity and running water to Iraq. First you destroy the electricity and running water, you bomb their utilities, and then you say, love me, I'm going to bring you electricity and running water. Not this year, but next year, whenever. Okay. So, whenever. The plutocracy in this country also operates on the assumption that the public treasury is at its disposal. So while you have a ruling class propaganda that says government is the cause of all your problems, stop running to government for a handout, do self-reliance, it's the free market that gives you your prosperity, While you have them saying that, these same people are going to government, going to the public treasury, and they're pulling out billions of dollars in equity subsidies, loan guarantees, export subsidies, research and development assistance, production loss compensations, tax write. If mom and pop go out of business, they don't get bailouts. They don't get bailouts from the federal government. But if Chrysler threatens to go out of business, what happens? Uncle Sam comes with hundreds of millions of dollars to help him out. Tax write-offs, grants and aid. Hundreds of billions of dollars every year go from the U.S. taxpayer to the Fortune 500. To them that have shall be given, to them that have not shall be taken even what little that they have. And the plutocrats operate on the assumption that the rest of us should learn to stand on our own feet and stop running to the government. Plutocracy also does not look with favor on the public sector. If you develop a public sector of services, or one of production, which we're not allowed to do in this country, the government can't go directly into market production. It's just simply not allowed. And there are laws against all that. But building public housing, building public health services, you are creating jobs, you're creating tax base, you get revenue back. You're creating services, you're answering human needs, and these plutocrats aren't making a penny on it. That's like Tony Soprano finding out all these new restaurants have opened up right in his neighborhood, and he doesn't get any take on it. And so they hate the public sector. The public sector demonstrates that you can actually have human needs taken care of, human production, all that sort of thing, human services, and these guys don't make a penny. And so the goal is to privatize this entire public sector, because then we get our take. And this take makes Tony Soprano look like a piker, right? What does he deal with? Thousands of dollars. We're talking about millions and billions of dollars here. The plutocrats are also good, like Tony is. They're good at dealing with and roughing up and beating up on those who can't defend themselves. The low income, the disabled. I'll tell you something else they're good at beating up on that can't defend itself. That's the environment. The environment can't defend itself. We have to defend it. And they're really good at it. They're really good. They see the environment, they see whatever natural resources are left, they see that if they have a right to whatever those natural resources are, they have a right to get it and use them as they want, when they want it, to maximize profit, quick cash, profits and the like. Another device they have is deficit spending. This is how the plutocracy uses our otherwise democratic government in the most undemocratic ways. It's a myth that right-wingers are fiscal conservatives. No one's a bigger, wilder spender than the reactionaries who are in power now. Ronald Reagan tripled the national debt from $800 billion to $2.3 trillion by the time he got out. George Bush added an additional $2 trillion to the national debt. Clinton reduced the debt somewhat and actually produced a surplus in his last two budgets. No deficit. What is a deficit? A deficit is when the government spends more money than it takes in revenues. How can it do that? It does that by borrowing from people who have lots of money. Rich creditors, banks, financial institutions, and the like. Floating government bonds. The national debt is the accumulation of these yearly deficits. Deficits and debts accomplish several things for rich conservatives. First, the debt is a source of safe investment and income for the creditor class. The bonds, those U.S. bonds you buy, you have the full faith and credit of the federal government behind them. It's a safe investment. And one of the things with people with billions of dollars is, what do I do with it? What do I put it into? Where can I put it? You know, that it'll be safe, or that it'll make me return life. The second thing is that deficits and debts represent an upward redistribution of income from the millions who work to the rich investors. Because what happens is, these investors lend billions of dollars every year to the U.S. government, and we, the people, the taxpayers, have to pay them back at interest that accumulates and accumulates and accumulates and grows. So we're borrowing from the people, the U.S. government is borrowing from the people who they should be taxing. Instead, they cut their taxes, and then they borrow money from them that we then have to pay them. So more and more of our federal budget is being privatized. That's the third function of debt and deficit. That in effect, you're privatizing the federal budget. A larger chunk of it is going every year to pay off rich creditors. Not for schools, not for hospitals, not for education, not for environmental protection, not for the fire service, not for rural electrification, not for housing, blah, blah. No, it's going to pay off rich creditors. The larger the debt, the larger the portion of your tax dollars that goes to the creditors. And fourth, finally, these huge deficits, $500 trillion in George W. Bush's budget this year, $500 trillion. These huge deficits become an excuse to cut the public sector services. We can't afford all these other silly luxury things like aid to disabled children. Right? Our governor right here, Muscles, didn't he just do that? His first act as governor of California was to cut the program to disabled children. I'm sorry, but we just have to do it. Well, through much of history then, the leaders of a capitalist state have been concerned with three things. First, to extract surplus value from the labor of the people, extract wealth, all the things I've just been saying, from the many, putting it in the coffers of the few. This whole process I'm describing, loan guarantees, export subsidies, well, it's all part of capital accumulation. Second function of the state is to protect that entire system of accumulation and upward redistribution. Keep the entire system of class control and class exploitation intact. Suppress resistance and dissident elements. And when that becomes too difficult, then grant concessions, incorporate changes into a new synthesis that helps the overall capitalist system to remain intact, but with a slightly more equitable distribution of wages and wealth. That's not class oppression, that's called class struggle. When people fight back and they make certain gains, and the guys at the top say, whoa, this is really getting hot, we better give in on this, better give in on that. The second function, though, the systemic function of systemically maintaining this system of expropriation is achieved with symbolic manipulation, informational control. I have water here already. Police state repression, control of the law and the courts and other auxiliary institutions. There's a third function that the capitalist state has, and this is the one I find very interesting, because I think it's really being overlooked by the reactionaries who are in power today. They're called conservatives. I don't get it. Why? A conservative, is someone who does not want any kind of change because he doesn't want any infringement on his powers and his privileges. These guys want change all over the place. They call them reforms, but they want rollbacks. They're changing everything. They want to get rid of Social Security. They want to get rid of environmental controls, the Clean Air Act, the fresh air. He's undermining the wetlands bills. He's undermining through executive orders, through reinterpretations. He's going at it one way or the other. They're rolling it all back. They learned from the Newt Gingrich days that if you try to do it in all one fell swoop, a Republican revolution, wipe it all out, yay, that can backfire. And even among your own Republicans, there are people who say, whoa, wait a minute, I like fresh air, clean air. And Gingrich had that happen. He had these ranchers writing in and said, what are you doing to the environment, you crazy jackass? So now what they do is by peace. But they're reactionaries, that's what they are. And these reactionaries have forgotten the third function. And that is, the third function of the capitalist state is to protect the owning class from itself, to protect it from its own avarice, to see that the parasite doesn't destroy the very organism upon which it battens. The capitalist state must keep the capitalist class from devouring itself. And we see that was happening with Enron, WorldCom, Halliburton, Harkin. The activist element of the investor class literally expropriating not only taxpayers and workers, but other investors. So hey, why worry about producing cars and refrigerators, then you gotta worry about trying to sell them and this and that and make a profit? Let's just go where the money is. Just tap into streams of money. Let's go. Who has money? Investors, pension funds, 401ks, all this stuff. Let's go and steal money from them. And they have been caught plundering investor income, billions of dollars. Many of these investors, of course, are small investors too, like pensions and all that. And this is a real crime. I mean, this is really now being looked at. And some of these guys are going to have to do hours of community service. I mean, I'm getting really tough here. Boy. I mean, you think I'm kidding. Look at Argentina. You remember what happened in Argentina a few years ago? I mean, I thought there was a case of the failure of the capitalist state to protect itself against capitalism. All of the people's pensions and monies and funds and everything, Argentina, this investor class went in there and stole. You don't understand, you're dealing with people who are insatiable. You're dealing with people who are absolutely ruthless. We are dealing with addicts. It's not true that coke or heroin is the worst addiction in America, or cigarettes, or alcohol. The worst addiction, the most crippling, the most damaging addiction is wealth. These people are just out of control. They just want more and more and more. And they're not unlike the ruling classes of all history. If the ruling classes of all history have ever wanted anything, there's only one thing they've ever wanted, and that's everything. They want all the lands, all the choice crops, all the herds, all the rich mineral deposits. They want control of all the labor, all the markets. They want all the civilities and comforts and luxuries of civil society while paying none of the costs. They want everything. And then when they got everything, they want still more. They want gold chalices to drink out of. They want $1,000 bills to light their cigars. They want, of course, the ruling class has learned since the days of the robber baron, they're not as crass and crude about it, but they are just as ruthless in their dedication to this accumulation. And I think that might be the crucial difference between the Democrats and the Republicans. That is, the Democrats are a capitalist party. They will tell you that. They're not so, they're capitalist. But they are different in that they do see this third function as important, that the state does have to occasionally rein in the avarice of the ruling class. So capital, other thing that capital has to do is it needs to continually expand, now on a global level. Ownership of the world's water supplies is next. A source of investment, ownership, and profit. A source of creating scarcity. A source of creating a new private market and more profits. Get people to work harder and harder so they have to pay a large chunk of their modest incomes for water. For water. So corporate capitalism moves restlessly into all corners of the world, destroying happy communities in the Philippines, in the Amazon, in Africa, in the United States for fast buck plunder. In the Philippines, you have these free business zones. They'll go into islands and communities where people have orchards and groves and fish and plant and have been living there for who knows how many centuries and living a good life, and they come in, drive these people off the land with these phony deeds, and then just harvest all the timber that's there, and tropical areas can't survive, that kind of thing. It turns it into a wasteland, worse for the ecology, worse for the air, worse for that. These people are driven off into the shanty towns, and there you got the free market, transnational corporate free market, doing its thing, pursuing its profits, and destroying human lives, human communities, ways of life, and the environment. So, this empire is not an end in itself. This empire, I wrote a book called Against Empire, and when it came out a few years ago, people said, empire, well, overstating it again. But I noticed that you got people from the Hoover Institute. You got people from the Hoover Institute who are writing books called Empire. You've got these right-wing pundits who overpopulate our media, are all of them talking about, we're an empire, and we ought to get used to it, and face up to it, and we got to start acting like an empire, and we got to maintain our credibility as an empire, and all that. Well, what is this empire for? This empire is not an end in itself. It's an instrument, as the Roman Empire was, as the British Empire was, as the Spanish Empire was. It's an instrument for extracting and grabbing wealth. It's an instrument of imperialism. So Max Weber was a bourgeois conservative social theorist, a non-Marxist. I give you a quote of his. He wrote this in about 1912. The question is, how are freedom and democracy in the long run at all possible under the domination of highly developed capitalism? That question, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, that question is still with us. How to defend and advance a political economic democracy in the face of corporate economic domination? Well, there exists not only class oppression, but class struggle. The many have been fighting back. Democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history to protect themselves from the oppressions and impoverishment caused by wealth and by the abuses of wealth. But democracy is more than just its electoral and representational procedures. It has a substance and a content. Oh, they'll give you the procedures. We can have elections for dog catcher, elections for president, elections for this, elections for assembly, elections for school board, elections all over the place. But democracy's got to be something more than just government of the people. It's got to be government for the people, for their needs, for their socioeconomic well-being, for it to be a real democracy. And today's rulers keep the appearance of democracy while undoing the substance and subverting the substance, while undoing the economic gains that we have won over the past century. And then when the people try to organize and resist this rollback, then they launch attacks against our very democratic rights. That when we try to protect our standard of living, our economic democracy, and to do that, we use our political democracy. They then attack our political democracy and our political rights. Or to George Bush summed it up in his inimitable way. He said, it sure would be a lot easier to govern if it was a dictatorship. And that's what they seem to be moving toward. Well, don't think for a moment that our reactionary rulers don't care what we think. That is their most important concern. Oh, do they care? Oh, are they watching? Oh, do they try to keep us convinced of their lies? They're trying to get in our heads all the time, getting into our heads. They're trying to close our mouths all the time. to wave the flag in our faces, to manipulate and pretend, to keep the boys and girls fighting and dying in some land which most of those kids couldn't have even found on the map last year. To some extent, ladies and gentlemen, to some extent, all regimes, all governments ultimately rest on public opinion. And when that opinion shifts, and when support declines, then those rulers have to backpedal. They have to hide their arrogance. They have to pretend that they share our outrage and our concerns, and they're as concerned as any of you, I swear. And to keep that pretense credible, they have to take actions and make concessions that they don't want to make at all. And that's what we've got to do. We've got to keep pressuring, agitating, getting our opinion out there at two levels. One, horizontally building our base wider and wider, and two, impacting vertically upon them and letting them know how we feel and what we feel. When the people are ready to lead, the leaders will eventually follow. Thank you, brothers and sisters.